Joining us in studio now is Bob Kettler, Robert Kettler, the founder and chairman of Kettler, of course. And you both found your way onto this list, and I'd like you both to talk about how you found out you were on this list.
Well, to be honest with you, hi, Rebecca.
Thank you. How are you?
Actually, that list found me. I mean, I found it on my desk. I think you found the same thing. And
Shinoy, it was on your desk one day?
Yeah, I got something in the mail inviting me to
He got something in the mail inviting him to something, he said.
I'm very honored, but I think both of us agree that it doesn't hold any weight at our houses in particular.
That's funny. Thank you for joining us, and congratulations to being on that list. Kettler was founded in 1977, and it's ranked among the top 20 multifamily housing developers in the nation and the largest land developer in metropolitan Washington. Kettler has developed more than 5 million square feet of commercial space and more than 50,000 housing units. So congratulations for accomplishing that, first of all.
Thank you very much.
And you are, is it a third-generation developer? Is that correct?
Third, maybe fourth. That's as far back as we can see. But my grandfather was a developer of apartment buildings in upper northwest Washington along Connecticut Avenue and in Adams Morgan with his brother. And then my father, uncle, and a number of other partners had a company called Kettler Brothers, which is still in existence, is a home building company owned by one of my cousins now. I'm the next generation. I founded Kettler when I was in college. I founded the company to put myself through my last few years of college. I started doing remodeling and building retail stores and that type of thing, and then started redeveloping small apartment buildings, and just grew from there.
So you went from doing the labor yourself.
That's
to now
right.
Owning the company that gets the labor done.
That's exactly right.
Interesting. Now, you've developed Sully Station, Virginia Run, Prince William Town Center. What planned community was the most challenging to you?
There's several that are challenging for a number of different reasons, but probably the most challenging from a political standpoint is we've been redeveloping, and we're just finishing now the redevelopment of the Lorton Penitentiary, which was a combination of big public-private partnerships, a combination of having to take brownfields and remediate them, building a transit station because it's on mass transit, and doing a lot of land assembly and infrastructure development within the community. Those are all public roads and interchanges, and we had to build a CSX bridge, and it was there needed to be transfers from the federal government to the county of Fairfax to us, and we built a high school and a golf course. And anyway, what we've wound up with is a town center and a high-density, transit-oriented, pedestrian-friendly community in an area that was really sort of underdeveloped and sort of dissed by the public, mm-hmm. because it was really known as an area for, having a prison that was run by the city in Fairfax County. It had a number of landfills in the area.
So there's a brand problem that a developer has to deal with.
Oh, absolutely. Particularly in redevelopment areas where there's been sort of loss of prices or abandoned homes and that type of thing. So yes, that was challenging from that standpoint. Back when we had the big real estate recession in the early 90s, there was challenges because all of our lenders continued to fail, and there was a banking crisis, and we needed to restructure and replan a lot of properties. We had a lot of properties going at that time, some of which were 6,000 units, and we successfully finished all those projects, like Cascades out in Loudoun County. That was 5 or 6 square miles of land, 3 miles, 4 miles of waterfront on the river, 2 golf courses, that type of thing.
Now, you also develop and own a majority interest in approximately 12,000 apartments in the area.
Right.
That's another. So what's interesting to me is that it seems to me that your company model is to, kind of be on both sides of the market, right? And people say, are apartments big now? Is housing big? And so that's something. Did you kind of set out to do that, to make sure you've got both sides?
Well, early in our business, we started doing land development and entitlement work, and started selling lots to builders as well as building houses. And then we realized when we were doing planned communities, you would get a little bit of commercial land with it. And it made a lot of sense from a tax standpoint to keep the commercial properties and develop them and have the cash flow, because you basically created value and didn't have to pay tax on it if you just kept it and never sold it. So that was our early business model. Being in the land business is too risky. You really need to have other forms of income, because the land cycle comes once every, seems like every 8 to 10 years. And, you know, when there's no land cycle, there's no money to make in it. And as a matter of fact, land doesn't pay you any income. It actually costs taxes and carry. Mm-hmm. So we decided that if we're going to sell lots to builders, we want to have a form of income that was stable. So we did something that was countercyclical to housing, which is the apartment business. When houses aren't selling, apartments tend to fill up. So we've built this big portfolio of apartments, and we started by doing tax credit apartments and lower income apartments. So we're the largest developer of affordable housing in the Washington metropolitan area, which we're very quite proud of that fact, because these are Class A apartments, but they rent to people with 40 to 70% median incomes, and we feel we're providing a really needed need in the housing market for this segment of the marketplace. Currently, we've also found out that as time's gone by, the creative class, which is, this is the largest concentration of creative class types, is in the Washington metropolitan area. The urbanization of the area and the transit-oriented projects are really where the action is now and where the future is. So we've started doing large-scale, high-rise, mixed-use projects, primarily on transit locations, metro or VRE, or we're building interchanges on highways that have HOV lanes and that type of thing. And that means that we've got commercial, we've got retail, we've got office, and we're in all those fields, hotel, hospitality as well as doing public-private partnerships.
So you've really taken the concept of diversification of your company portfolio seriously.
Right, exactly.
Do you attribute to some success to that?
Yes, because if you look at the home building industry, which those are our primary customers in our land business, that's an industry that really is, you know, most of the home builders are trading at under 50% of their peak values. They've got capital issues. There's a whole issue with the mortgage mess and the vertical integration of mortgage companies with home builders. Those are all issues that are going to keep that industry down. And right now, it's going to create a problem in the future, because they're unloading land when they really should be building their pipeline for the future. But they have to get rid of it because they have capital needs. So it's really a broken industry. And we didn't want to get stuck with a single product. We wanted to have the real estate industry, you roll through these cycles that aren't on top of each other. Mm-hmm. So you might have an amplitude of the housing cycle might be up here while the rental cycle's down here, and it tends to even things out. And having recurring income is really the key to it.
So would you argue, I'm sure, developers have gone out of business. Would you argue that part of this kind of philosophy is what's kept you in business?
Oh, absolutely. And allowed us to grow when actually the rest of the industry seems to be shrinking. And there are a number of people we model ourselves after. I mean, there's a Lerner family here. They have a variety of different products. They've diversified into baseball, too. So baseball.
So, you're going towards golf, I see.
We've got a lot of golf courses.
A lot of golf courses, and you're redesigning two new championship golf courses currently, right?
That's right.
Is that an area of interest for you?
It is, yes, primarily because it's an amenity in our communities. I mean, really where we're going with our community business, whether it's high-rise or whether it's suburban, is that we want to have a wellness facility, we want to have programming. We're actually talking to the people of Revolution about putting together an amenity management company that would run things programmatically like a spa or a resort, but in a primary living environment.
Wow, wonderful. We are speaking with the founder and chairman of Kettler, Bob Kettler. And when we get back, we are going to talk more about, I know you're interested in the housing market, and we touched on that a little bit, but we're going to talk more about his thoughts on what's going on there and his growth. How did he become the largest land developer in metropolitan D.C.? That's all on the Leader Spot, where you can check out his interview as well as Sudhakar Shenoy's interview. That's all there on theleaderspot.com. Information about how to find out about their companies is also listed right there. And you can see photos of them as well. That's all on the Leader Spot. Back after this. We're back here on the Leader Spot. I'm Rebecca Blacksmith, the founder and chairman of Kettler, Robert Kettler. Bob joined us on the other side, and now we're talking about how he's become the number one, the largest land developer in metropolitan Washington. He mentioned earlier number one in affordable housing in this region, as well as ranked on among the top 20 in multifamily housing developers in the nation. Talk to me, Bob, about the growth. How did you get there? 1977 you started, and you're here now. We talked a little bit about your formula for growth of diversification. How else did you do it? Did you was it a strong management team? Was it a vision, or was it all that? Kind of explain that.
Well, early in our business, our original business model, I think I mentioned earlier, was that we would be a planned community. We were a planned community developer and a home builder, and we found that the margins in home building were like the grocery store. They were really 3 or 4% net, and you're not going to get large or really be able to do significant things with that kind of income growth if you're working on your own capital. So what we did is we went into the planned community business, where we would assemble ground, entitle it, and then we would use banks as partners. This was our first business model in the 80s. And we grew quite large that way because we had the working capital, and also through the entitlement process, and also the synergies of having mixed products and amenities and communities added value compared to just houses mm-hmm. along the side of the road or 5, 10, 15 unit subdivisions. So we created a lot of value that way. Then the real estate recession hit in the early 90s. A lot of, I think, 12 of our 16 banks we were dealing with either were consolidated into other banks. Most of them failed, and it was just chaotic for years. And we came out of that wanting to diversify. So we diversified first into affordable housing, which we got capital by selling tax credits. After we made enough money, we started building apartments on our own. But then we really, and since the year 2000, we've really started using institutional partners. So we're now partners with Staubach, Massachusetts Mutual, the Principal, ING, Clark Construction, J.P. Morgan. I mean, these are the types, and on and on. We have a number of these, multiple projects with all of these people and institutions. And we're doing projects that are 200, 300, 400. We even have one project in Pentagon City that's a couple of $1 billion. And they're all funded. They all have adequate capital. They're all non-recourse typically to our company, which means that we're not taking, we're not risking our company for these big sort of mega projects. And we've built enough staff and enough capabilities, enough different fields that, and we have enough of a track record that we're very attractive to these institutional type of investors. And as you know, over the last few years with private equity and hedge funds, there's been a lot of liquidity. So yes, there are some issues in the capital markets now, but what we're typically seeing is pricing a spread above our basis, which might be LIBOR, it might be 10-year, whatever our debt is priced against. You know, it's just a little more margin, but bond prices are down. So we're really not seeing a lot of impact.
How often do you lose money in a project? And have you been able to, as a CEO, made that less? Or is it still way market driven?
If we have a project, we typically, if we're going to lose money on a project, quite honestly, we're typically going to jettison the project before we start it. So a lot of projects will tie up and we'll do a lot of due diligence. But we won't start a project unless one of these bigger projects. And I'm talking about mm-hmm. maybe a, you know, $150 million or $200 million big high-rise project. We'll try to lock everything down, including our spread and a takeout from an institutional market. And still, we'll still have the management. We'll still have a percentage of the deal, maybe 50% of it. But in so far, we haven't had a project implode on us where we had a construction problem or we had a major issue with the development of the project like that. You know, hopefully, you know, we're well insured for those types of things. But these big, huge projects, you don't want to come out of the ground unless you've basically got everything pretty much bolted down.
Interesting. Now, I have a friend at Prudential Real Estate Investments, and I was talking about this interview, and he said to me, you know, Rebecca, developers are like mayors. That's how we define a developer. They can hang out with the urban kid, the people in the neighborhood, the stock market, the city council, and somehow have faith of all those different people. And you were referring to, like, affordable housing, right? So you mm-hmm. even affordable housing, you know, tenants, you have to have the faith of. Do you think that's a correct assessment of what a good developer is?
Yes,
I think you have to be personable, and you have to relate to all those communities well.
I think you definitely need to be able to relate to communities and be credible with a community, because most of the projects, if they're complicated, require a political approval, whether the code says so or not. If it's not popular and it's not doesn't have the support of the community, it's really not going to go anywhere. I mean, it's really, and we actually don't like to get into those types of deals where you could go to court and make it happen. It's just not worth the time or just the stress. But the but yes, you have to relate to all those different constituencies, and you have to do it in a positive and in a way that's credible.
We are speaking with the founder and chairman of Kettler, Robert Kettler, and I know people listening. We've got, you know, an investor community out there listening. They want to know what's going on with the market. And my question for you as a leader is, are you waiting to see what happens in the market, or are you making decisions for your company based on that, or do you not even care because you're so diversified?
A little of all those things. I'll tell you that the housing market is not in good shape. The public home builder market and the private home builder market is not in good shape. Condominium market's not in good shape. But the apartment market's never been better. Commercial real estate is still great. Retail, highest rents ever, and people are still shopping. And then there are new products that are transit-oriented that have a lot of demand. And then there are different submarkets in the Washington area for housing that are still doing quite well. And then we have our whole apartment business, which has never been better. We've got the lowest vacancy rates in our history. We've got the highest rents in our history. And we've got the lowest cap rates in history if we want to sell projects. So we've been selling some projects as we've been, and we've been buying projects. So on what you're really asking about is the residential side of the business. And what we did about 5 years ago is we established, because there's so much data out there now and there's so much expertise in data mining, that we've really put together a top staff of economic development people. We've hired people with degrees, advanced degrees from MIT, who do just a lot of number crunching. And what we do is we monitor every submarket. We have our own proprietary database, and we actually graph where prices are in the resale business. We're looking at all inventory. We're looking at conversions. We're looking at standing inventory. We're looking at the performance in maybe 15 separate submarkets in the Washington area. And I can tell you what I think is going to happen in terms of inventory burning off and what I think is going to happen in pricing and all those. And just to give you a thumbnail of it, the condominium market has about 2 years of supply left in it. But a lot of that product is converting to rental. And as that happens, that supply will burn off faster. But at the current sales rate that's occurring right now, it's about a 2 year burn. There's a lot of product that gets mixed up with for sale, which skews numbers. There's been a lot of converted, and those are really opportunistic deals where apartments were converted to condominiums. That doesn't add to the housing stock. All it's doing is changing it from rental to ownership, but it doesn't add a unit to the marketplace. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of that stuff flip-flopping back and forth, and it gets mixed up in the sales numbers, which kind of skews data, and it really should be thrown out and looked at separately. And so there's some of that that's sort of making the numbers look worse than they are. A lot of the product that's called condominiums is going to wind up being rentals. And the rental marketplace can absorb that right now. In terms of sales of new houses, it's actually up in Loudoun County and Prince William County, up by 5 to 10% in both of those. So that's because sales prices are down about 10%. So I think this fall what you're going to see are a lot of promotions. A lot of people are just going to get rid of their inventory. It's like having too many pumpkins the day after Halloween, you know. I mean, they don't have a lot of value. And so the inventory, they're going to find the price points that it moves. There are a lot of people that want to buy houses that are sitting on the sidelines. They don't want to be. They don't want their friends to think they didn't. They bought before the bottom hit. So the amount of traffic we have on our projects is extraordinary. And last weekend and the week before, all of a sudden we saw a surge in sales. And that's because we're doing what everybody else is doing. We're finding where the market is, and we're trying to help people. The mortgage crisis has only exacerbated a situation that was starting to flatten out about the middle to end of July anyway. So you had the slowest month of the year. You had worse news every day for 30 days. We think that sort of played itself out. Yeah, there's going to be a lot of foreclosures. D.C. doesn't have a high foreclosure rate. It's one-third of what it is in the rest of the country. Arizona, Florida, Nevada, and California actually skew the numbers up over last year. If we didn't have those four states and you took them out, foreclosure numbers would be lower than last year. So there's
interesting.
There's things out there that don't get reported. It's you know, sometimes the media, I think, just likes to beat the drum on the bad story. But
it's almost like it's more complicated. It's not this obvious housing is up, housing down. It's, you know, you're even talking to regional, like, they're, you know, growth in certain areas. I've heard that so many times before. It doesn't really matter. You don't want to say housing down. You want to say where and under what conditions.
Well, look, there's a huge number of condos and apartments being built on the Massachusetts Avenue corridor, like from 8th Street down to 4th Street in that general area down near the new convention center. Those aren't being discounted. Those are selling at $500, $525 a foot. That's just a regular imbalance market. You look at Alexandria, where there are not a lot of young people. There's more old people. Those condominiums are sitting. In Arlington, it's sort of a mixed bag depending on the pricing. There's too much supply, but there are a lot of young people that want to buy. I mean, every market's got its own story. And, you know.
Yep. It makes a lot of sense.
So.
Now, you won Developer of the Year by the National Association of Home Builders in 1986. So my question for you is, what makes a great, not just a good developer?
I was just a child then, so I think I was still in high school. I don't know. We put together a number of planned communities real early in our career. I think I was 34, 33 years old then, and we had explosive growth, and we were making zoning agreements and entitlement deals with the different counties that included building a lot of infrastructure. So we were building interchanges, we were building big 4- and 6-lane roads, we were building entire parkway systems as conditions of our land use, which was, we kind of started that trend. And we also started developing pedestrian-oriented communities in the mid 80s, and we had different types of merchandising that was different. New York Times, and the National Geographic, which people hadn't advertised real estate in those types of venues before. So we had a whole different model and package for our communities. And I think we started doing that in 86, and that's when I won that award.
Now, are you an equity or are you a debt developer, or does it depend on the project? I'm sure you have some theories around this, too.
We're both. I mean, we've got a brand new project in Reston. It's a $120 million apartment building, and our partner in that is ING, and we built that. It's all cash. We have no debt. We have other projects that are 100% leveraged because it makes sense and because we have an institutional takeout. So the debt is the cheapest way to get to the end, and then we'll put a permanent mortgage on it and have a split of equity and debt depending on the marketplace when we get there. But like I said, we don't do those kind of projects where we take the risk. It's way too much money.
And you're at a place now, too, as a company.
Yes. Yeah, so, we're rebranded. We just changed the name. We're the sponsor of the new Kettler Capitals Iceplex, so we have this strategic relationship with the Capitals and Ted Leonsis and all the guys at Lincoln, and we're trying to become more of a brand.
Well, best of luck with that.
Thank you.
Developing your brand and houses and apartments and everything you have planned for the future. We appreciate you being on the show.
Thank you.
Robert Kettler here with us, the founder and chairman of Kettler here with us on the Leader Spot.